we're doing a series, an eight-week series on the history of the RPCNA, and I'll do a really fast review of what we did last week, and then we'll get into this week. Remember, we talked about, we very quickly covered from the time of the apostles up to the Protestant Reformation. We covered it in about 5 minutes, and that's thousands of years. But anyways, we covered that. We saw how the Protestant Reformation sort of happened with Martin Luther, and then we saw how that spread to Scotland. And Scotland is in Great Britain, which is an island away from the mainland. And so how did it come to that island? We saw how it did. It threw people like Patrick Hamilton, especially, who died, remember, after only a few months of ministry. And then also George Wishart, and then lastly John Knox, we talked about. So quiz for last week, what color hair was John Knox's hair? Red, yeah. So that's important. That's the most important thing we learned about last week. So, and then we saw how the Church of Scotland, which had been Catholic for years, just like the rest of Europe, became Reformed, became Presbyterian, and then we saw the conflict, because the Reformation in Scotland was grassroots. It was commoners, it was royal or nobles, it was the clergymen. And we saw that conflict with Mary, Queen of Scots, and that she was still Catholic, and we saw the conflict there, and John Knox and she, and that conflict. So we'll continue on from there. But before we do that, this nice, simple slide is an overview of kind of Scottish-British royalty from basically 1500 to 1700, 200 years, and it's kind of complicated, and it's helpful to understand, I think, as we talk more about the Church of Scotland, because this is the interaction they have with whoever's king. And so you have two royal dynasties, kind of. You have the Scottish kings and the English kings, and the Scottish kings are the Stuarts, and the English kings are the Tudors. And you probably know about the Tudors. You know Henry VIII. He reformed the Church of England so he could marry a different woman, basically. Maybe that's too simple, but and his thing, and actually the three following people, Edward, Mary, and Elizabeth, were all his children. And you remember Edward became king as a young boy and then died. He was kind of a sickly boy, and then there was this an attempt to make Lady Jane Grey queen for 9 days. I didn't put her on here. She didn't make the cut. And then Mary Queen, or Bloody Mary, became queen. She didn't make the cut. Yeah. And then Bloody Mary becomes queen, and then Elizabeth. And then what I want to point out is Elizabeth dies, and there's some intermarrying going on between the Stuarts and the Tudors. And so the next person in line is King James VI of Scotland. And so he now becomes King James I of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and the whole thing. And that's quite a promotion, because Scotland, England is several times bigger than Scotland, so quite a movement up for him. So that will come into play more. We'll see that later today, but just wanted to show that. And the other thing to notice is certain kings and queens, their toleration of Protestantism and Presbyterianism varied. You had Edward, who really regents ruled in this place. They were very pro-Protestant, so it was a good time to be a Protestant in England. When William and Mary come to the power later, he's the last one there. They're very pro-Protestant, so it's a good time. But under Mary, who's Bloody Mary, under especially Charles II and James II, there's severe persecution. And we'll see that. So the time of the Scottish martyrs happens under Charles II and James II, the last two on the right, except for William there. So anyways, that's an overview. We'll get more into the detail, but I just thought it might be helpful to see that before we go on. So that's an overview of the Scottish-British royalty. And then, so last week we had talked about, the church in Scotland is reformed, primarily under the leadership of John Knox. And now we want to kind of move forward from there and say we see this time in the history of Church of Scotland where there's a struggle between Presbyterianism and prelacy. And we probably know what Presbyterianism is. That's, a congregation has elders that kind of rule that church. And then they, with other elders of other congregations, come together in a presbytery. And then they, with other presbyteries, come together as a synod or a general assembly. And it's a, I don't know if democratic's the right word, but it's sort of that representative kind of thing more versus prelacy, which is really ruled by bishops. And bishops are appointed by the person above them, and it's hierarchy, and it's a bishop, an archbishop, and so forth. And we'll see that. And we have a king who likes prelacy, likes being the one to appoint archbishops and bishops and things like that on one side. And then Presbyterianism, which is, again, sort of more democratic, more harder to control for a king. And that's really the struggle that's happening during this time. And so, you know, we talked about John Knox. The next guy we want to talk about today is Andrew Melville. And he lived from 1545 to 1622. And if you think of John Knox as sort of being the leader of the Scottish church during the time of Mary, Queen of Scots, and it's John Knox versus Mary, I think with Andrew Melville, you can think of him as being the leader versus King James. And while, you know, Melville and Knox weren't really official, the official leader of the church, right, because it's Presbyterian, they weren't bishops or archbishops, but they were very influential people, and they are kind of viewed as sort of the key people of their time. And so Knox kind of contended against Mary, Queen of Scots, and Melville contended against James. And Melville, like Knox, had spent time in Geneva, not when John Calvin was there after Calvin had gone, but he was in Geneva, was very reformed, came back to Scotland 3 years after John Knox dies. So that's kind of why we talk about Knox and then Melville, because they kind of lived during or were involved in the church at different times. And Melville was a neat character. Let me give you a quote. This is your first quote there from J.G. Voss. Andrew Melville was not only a man of great courage, but a man of great learning. His boldness and uncompromising spirit caused him to be summoned in 1584 to appear before the Privy Council to answer for what were alleged to be treasonable speeches and prayers. Melville appeared before the council, protested against their summons, and boldly claimed the right of freedom of speech and the autonomy of the church in spiritual matters. And that phrase, the autonomy of the church, that means the freedom of the church from the king's power. That was, you know, Knox was really big on that, but that was Melville's thing. He was all about, you know, if you thought of the divine right of kings, so God gives me the right to do whatever I want, rule however I want. Melville would argue the divine right of presbytery, saying God gives the church to the, you know, Presbyterian form of government. There is no earthly authority that can tell the Presbyterian church what to do. It's, you know, it has its divine right, so to speak. And so he was real big on that and really is kind of the champion of that. And the second quote there from J.G. Voss, which is quite long, but I think this is what Melville is probably most famous for. So I'll read this kind of in its entirety, but realize this isn't Melville writing a letter or preaching a sermon that's transcribed and sent to James. This is face-to-face, personal, you know, interaction with the king, and you'll see that as we read this. But just think of the, you know, this isn't a letter, okay? This isn't an email. This isn't a Facebook post. This is serious business. So from J.G. Voss, Melville was one of a group of ministers sent to confer with the monarch. The king had a mind of his own about the government of the church and was not inclined to make any concessions. Melville took the king by the sleeve and told him to listen to what the ministers had to say and addressed him thus. Sire, there are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is King James, the head of this commonwealth, and there is Christ Jesus, the king of the church, whose subject James the Sixth is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member. We will yield to you your place and give you all obedience. But again, I say, you are not the head of the church. You cannot give us that eternal life which we seek for even in this world, and you cannot deprive us of it. Permit us then freely to meet in the name of Christ and to attend to the interests of that church of which you are a member. Sire, when ye was in your swaddling clothes, Christ reigned freely in this land. His ministers and servants did then freely in his name what they ought to do. And now, when ye are come to the kingdom, will ye take it upon you to make encroachments? Okay, so again, that's face-to-face interaction. That's a bold statement. But you can see that he's saying, yes, you are king. You're king of this nation and stuff. But there's two kingdoms. There's the church, and you are not the king of the church. You are not the head of the church. And that was Melville kind of in a nutshell. So, go ahead, James. No, because he's referring to him as James the Sixth. I think this happened in, this is 1596. I think he became king in 1603, or became unified king in 1603. So, yeah, and that's the thing. He's James the Sixth now. He'll then become James the First because he gets to restart it. And then he's like First and Sixth. So I don't know how that works, but it's fun, complicated stuff. So. Okay, so again, that's Melville. He is kind of champion of this divine right of presbytery. But needless to say, you know, James comes, you know, again, James became king when he was just a little baby. It wasn't until later that he actually kind of becomes, you know, acting king. And when he became acting king, he starts to do this, and then you'll see it just gets more and more like that. But if you think of 1560 as being when the Reformation sort of began in Scotland with John Knox, from 1560 to 1567, the Reformation catches fire, okay? Because in 1560, you have four pastors that are reformed. In 1567, 7 years later, there's 250 pastors that are reformed. So think of that. That's incredible growth and change in a short time. And so by 1567, the church in Scotland is reformed. It's very prestigious. It's powerful. It's got a lot of backing from the nobles, a lot of whom are now Protestant. And so it's sort of a good place for the Protestant church. But soon after that, in 1572, And this slide sort of walks through some dates, but you'll see these kind of compromises and changes over time. The first one was the Convention of Leith, which, you know, again, what the issue is, you have all these former bishops in the former, you know, Church of Scotland, and now we're Reformed and Presbyterian. What do we do with all these bishops? And there was a compromise that said, well, they can keep calling themselves bishops, and we'll refer to them as bishops, but they don't have any power beyond that of a normal pastor or minister. And you can see if Scotland is used to hundreds and hundreds of years of having bishops and archbishops in the hierarchy, you know, having sort of someone that's called a bishop but not a bishop would be confusing. And so this is sort of the first compromise down this road of what we'll call prelacy. And the other thing too is King James is a very clever guy, very cunning. He's thinking about this. He's strategic, and there, you know. When they make this compromise, you know, he's going to use that to his benefit later on. So those kind of two things. You got the history of hierarchy in Scotland. How could they not think of them as bishops? Then you got the king of Scotland who is wanting prelacy, and he's going to tweak it how he likes it. So that was sort of the first compromise. There's struggles that go back and forth. In 1578, you do have a general assembly that Melville is the moderator at, and they come out with a new book of church discipline, and they actually say in that for the first time that Presbyterianism is the scriptural form of church government. You know, it's not a preference. I'm not choosing it over this. It's saying scripture says it's Presbyterianism as opposed to something else. So a much stronger stance on it. So you see, there's the Presbyterian side, and then the struggle back with the prelacy. In 1584, just a few years later, Parliament, which is sort of being manipulated by King James, passes what are called the Black Acts. And let me read the third quote there from J.G. Voss in your paper. Parliament sat behind closed doors. All the anti-prelatic acts, so that would be the Presbyterian acts, of the General Assembly were declared to be treason. Parliament confirmed the king's royal power over all states and subjects within this realm. It was declared unlawful for the General Assembly to meet without the royal consent. The ministers must acknowledge the bishops as their superior officers. The nobility and gentry yielded to these measures, but the ministers opposed them. Okay, so you have serious changes there. And so you have, you know, the government, the parliament saying one thing, and you have the Church of Scotland sort of saying another thing, and there's all this confusion. And then in 1592, before 1592, King James is kind of in the mainland dealing with some war campaigns and things, other things, not thinking about Scotland. He's kind of busy. Comes back to Scotland in 1592 and is sort of pleased that, you know, I passed these Black Acts a few years ago, and there hasn't been a lot of revolting or rebellion. So he was kind of happy with what he saw. So the church thought this is a good time to maybe approach him and ask him for some things. So they came to him and said, here's a list of our requests and things. And so he, in a good mood, sort of went to Parliament and said, you know, take these up, do what you want with them. And so they, in 1592, they came up with what is called the Great Charter of Presbytery. It got rid of the Black Acts. Let me see what it else did. The key thing it did maybe is to say that ministers no longer were confirmed or appointed by bishops, but that they were ordained by presbyteries. And it, you know, it was a good thing. But it was still a compromise, I think. And the crucial thing to point out is back in 1560 to 1567, you have the church that is independent of the king. It's an inherent right to be the church. It doesn't matter what the king does. It doesn't matter what the king says. It's the church. And now what's happening in 1584, 1592, the king is saying to the church, you can be Presbyterian, you can be. And so you see that it's a granted privilege instead of an inherent right. And that was a change, and I think that's kind of the crucial thing. Okay, so 1592, great act of, or great charter of presbytery. It's a big deal there. Well, we're getting up. Remember, 1603 is when King James sort of becomes king of the whole unified Great Britain. So we're getting close to that. And so Elizabeth dies. James the Sixth of Scotland becomes James the First of England, and that becomes this much more powerful king. Sort of the ultimate goal of his career, so to speak. And soon after that, in 1610. King James uses the General Assembly now instead of Parliament to really put into effect episcopacy. And so now your fourth quote, and this is another long one, but this is from J.G. Voss recounting this General Assembly in 1610. When the General Assembly met in Glasgow on the 8th of June, 1610, it proved to be a packed court. And I think packed, he's not saying full, he's saying hand-selected, okay, a packed court. King James sent letters to the several presbyteries directing them who to send as commissioners to the assembly. When the assembly met, bribery was freely used to influence the members in the king's favor. The Earl of Dunbar came from London with a large quantity of gold coins called angels, from which circumstances the assembly of 1610 was called the Angelical Assembly. So it's an interesting little factor. These coins were distributed to the commissioners. Those are the representatives coming to the General Assembly, ostensibly to defray their traveling expenses, as some had come from long distances. But Rowe records that some near Glasgow who voted the king's way got the wages of Balaam, while some gracious ministers in the north who voted negatively got no gold at all. Okay, so the money is for reimbursing travel expenses, but it's, how it got allocated begs to differ. Okay. In the end, the king's proposals were carried with but five negative votes. The Parliament in 1612 ratified the acts of the General Assembly. The Parliament also declared that the king was the only lawful supreme ruler in Scotland in all matters, both ecclesiastical, that's in the church, and temporal, that's in the government. This act of Parliament gave full legal sanction to episcopacy in Scotland. And this, and there was actually some kind of sharp, short conflict over that, but that didn't last long, and King James sort of carried the day. And Andrew Melville and about 20 other ministers are either exiled or imprisoned or sort of just put away, and so King James gets his way. And so now he's sort of said, now he's put in episcopacy, which is, again, bishops. The king appoints an archbishop, the archbishop appoints bishops, the bishops appoint the pastors, and, it's all controlled by King James. So he's done that, and then he next introduces worship innovations in the 1680 Acts of Perth. And those included things like private baptism, private communion, a requirement to kneel when you're receiving communion, and again, instead of ordination by a presbytery, it's back to confirmation by the bishop. So he changes all those things, and this is by, within 50 years of the Reformation happening, you're back to full-blown Episcopalianism, and it's really no different than the Church of England, which James is also the head of that. And that really was his goal, to make Scotland and England kind of one thing under his rule, both civil and church. And to sum it up, the fifth quote there from J.D. Douglas, it became apparent that James' ruling passion was the complete union of his two kingdoms. As a necessary step toward this end, he set about de-Presbyterianizing Scotland and making its church a northern counterpart of the Church of England. This program involved two features primarily: the setting up of a bench of bishops with, I have trouble with this word, diocesan powers, and the introduction of Episcopalian practices into public worship. In 1610, therefore, a completely Episcopal system was introduced into Scotland. In 1612, the estates or the Parliament obediently ratified the new order of church government. Okay, so you can see James is, he did it slowly, he did it smartly, he did it kind of in a strategic, clever way, and really up to this point it had worked how he wanted it. But, so you have what we call the Second Reformation in Scotland. And James, remember, James has a son named Charles. James dies in 1625, and his son, Charles, succeeds to the throne of Great Britain, the whole unified throne. And while James had been conniving and clever, as J.D. Douglas talks about James, he says, when the government of the church had thus been changed and its rituals modified, the king again for a space lay low, content with his exercise and recognition of his supremacy. While he still showed his adherence to the divine right, that's the divine right of kings, he ruled the church through general assemblies, thus showing lip service to the generally recognized machinery of legislation. James knew his own strength and never quite overstepped the mark in all his dealings with Scotland. It had been James' boast that he knew the stomach of his Scottish subjects. Okay. While James was clever and cunning, you have Charles, his son, who, from one of the authors, said he was an earnest and stupid man. That was a direct quote. I wouldn't say that about him. But he was. And he was sort of bold and you know, stubborn, where his father had been a little more willing to compromise and work through things and stuff. So Charles is totally different from his father. The first thing he does, or one of the first things he does after being king, is he goes and marries Henrietta Maria of France, who was a Roman Catholic. And again, he's the king, the head of a Protestant nation. The first thing he does is go and marry a Catholic woman. Again, it's sort of he was going to do what he wanted to do regardless. And so that's one of the first things he does. For the first 12 years of his reign, he, like his father for a time, was dealing with struggles in mainland wars and things like that, dealing with issues in England. And so he left Scotland alone for 12 years. Really just couldn't get up there to deal with them. And then in 1637, 12 years after he's king, he decides it's time to start changing the Church of Scotland. And the way he does that is... There's a man, William Laud, who's the Archbishop of Canterbury, so sort of the head of the church in England. He kind of oversees this writing of a book, and it's either called the Book of Common Prayer or Laud's Liturgy or the Book of Canons. It has a lot of different names. But it's a book that's sort of saying, here's how you're going to worship. And they write this book in England and send it up to Scotland to be used. And the first time the book was used in a church in Scotland was in Edinburgh, in the town or in the church, the St. Giles Church. And that's a picture of it down at the bottom left there. It's still there today. And so, you know, July 23rd is a Sunday in 1637, and they're going to introduce this Book of Common Prayer. And the story goes that, you know, the minister opens the book, starts reading to it. And there was a lady there, and her name was Jenny, I think, Geddes, I think it's Jenny Geddes, and she was a common woman, kind of a street seller, worked in the market and things like that. But she's there sitting on her stool, and she starts hearing him read from this Book of Common Prayer. She takes her stool and she throws it at the minister, and quoting from, I forget who this is from, but I have this in your notes if you want to read it. This is what she's reported to have said. She said, "Devil cause you colic in your stomach, false thief. Dare you say the mass in my ear?" Okay, so nice theological response there. But she's angry, and that phrase, "Dare you say the mass in my ear?" She's hearing the popery, the Roman Catholicism again, and that's bothering her, and that's what she's doing. So she throws her stool. It starts this kind of riot in the church, and there is a little bit of question, apparently, if you read too many books, you get conflict, that whether there was an actual woman that did that, or whether if it was sort of a other things said it was a group of women that did it, you know. So I don't know if this stool was actually thrown or something, but there was a riot in that church that day over the introduction of that book, for sure. And I kind of like the story of her better than any other story I read, so we'll go with that. And that riot in Edinburgh kind of began a revolution in the entire nation, and really, it wasn't just a book of, you know, prayers and sort of a, it was more than that. And to read from J.D. Douglas, the Book of Canons, which again is another name for that book, the Book of Canons required explicit acknowledgement of the royal supremacy. It swept away the remaining framework of the Presbyterian Church at which James VI or first had been chipping sporadically for years. transferred full power to the bishops, threatened excommunication on those who, for biblical reasons, condemned the liturgy and on those who rejected episcopacy. All was done in striking defiance of the known wishes of most of the people and under the control of the king, the English, and an ecclesiastical system which the entire country was increasingly learning to dislike. Okay, so again, you see James was slowly changing it. Charles comes in and just, boom, changes it, and it didn't go well. All these riots are happening, and Charles has counselors, you know, and they're telling him, maybe you should back off. You know, maybe this isn't worth your while. And he wisely doesn't listen to them and pushes them out further and further. So the Church of Scotland, sort of through the formal, normal ways, protests. You know, they come to the king and say, hey, you know, this, why are you doing this to us? And responding to them, he just basically calls them, you know, rebelling and treason and all that kind of stuff. And so it didn't work with them in that setting. And so what the Scottish church and the Scottish people end up doing is they write what's referred to as the National Covenant. And that was in 1638. And this is a rabbit trail, so I'm warning you, it's a rabbit trail. But I want to talk about a guy named Alexander Henderson. And he was really the key leader of the Second Reformation in Scotland. He was the chief author of the National Covenant. He was the chief author later of the Solemn League and Covenant, which we'll get to. He was moderator of the Scottish General Assemblies at time. And the Scottish delegation that went to Westminster Assembly, which we'll talk about later, he was the chief or the leader of that delegation. So very prominent person in the Church of Scotland at this time. And the story of his early life is really interesting. He would have grown up during this kind of back and forth between the Church of Scotland on one side and James on the other, and the confusion of prelacy versus Presbyterianism. But he grew up and was trained to be a minister and was definitely on the side of prelacy. And so he's trained, he's ordained by the archbishop, and then the archbishop sends him to a little congregation in a town called Lucers, Scotland. And Henderson, reflecting back on this, would say he wasn't even a Christian at this time, much less Reformed. He wasn't even a Christian at this time. So he's sent to this little congregation, and the congregation's, you know, this country congregation. It's very Reformed, very Presbyterian. And they hear about this new pastor that the archbishop sent in their way, and they're not thrilled with it. So what they decide to do, you know, he's going to come. They're going to have an installation service and install them as their pastor. The whole congregation goes into the church, locks all the doors, and it's like a last act of desperation. Well, if we lock the doors, he can't get in to be installed. And so they think that's the way to handle it. Well, Henderson gets there, finds all the doors locked, goes around, finds a window, breaks the window, climbs into the window, and then they have to have the installation service. So that's how he was installed. Yeah, you know, very kind of funny story, really. But Henderson's a pastor for a while, and then he hears about this Reformed pastor who's kind of coming through the area preaching, and he says, I'm just going to go listen to him, see what he's about. And the guy's name was Robert Bruce, if that matters, not Robert the Bruce. That's a few hundred years earlier. But Robert Bruce is this Reformed preacher. He's preaching on John 10. John 10, verse 1, I'll read it, says, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. Henderson apparently is, I'm sure he was making the connection there, but he is actually convicted, converts, and then even becomes Reformed, and then becomes the leader of the Scottish church there for a long time. So just a neat, that was worth the rabbit trail, right? So I thought that was just a great story. So anyways, but back to the National Covenant, which Henderson was the chief author of it. So that, you know, Scotland writes this National Covenant, and after that's written, people sign it. And it's signed by ministers, it's signed by noblemen, it's signed by commoners. And many of the people who signed it in their own blood. You know, this is a serious covenant. And they estimate that eventually it's signed by 300,000 people. And do you remember how many people were in Scotland at this time? Roughly a million. A million, yeah. So a third of the nation signs this covenant. And you think, you know, we think of the U.S. Constitution as being the will of the American people, right? Everybody, Constitution. But think how the U.S. Constitution passed. It was, you know, barely passed in turn, you know, and here you have a third of every person in the nation who signs the covenant. So I think you could say the National Covenant was a true reflection of the will of the people of Scotland. The contents of the covenant, really quickly, I won't go into this a lot, but like all Presbyterian documents, the first thing it did was condemned Roman Catholicism and the Pope, and then it got focused on, it committed to defending the Reformed religion in Scotland, and it promised to support the king if he defended the religion and laws of the country. So they said, we'll support you if you, you know, promote the Reformed religion. And that was always the thing. You know, the if is the key word there. And let me read, I won't read that next quote from J.G. Voss, but it's talking about, it was really a legal document in a way. It was a plea to the king to follow the laws of the country. And the people who signed that national covenant were referred to commonly as the Covenanters. And that name stuck from then on, kind of. So, and, you know, RPCNA was sometimes called the Covenanter Church, and that's where it comes from. So this is the first use of that word, at least in identifying this group of people. Okay? So, again, you have Scotland has just made this national covenant. It's and that's in response to what Charles has done. And so good, wise Charles is figuring out what to do. And actually, at this point, he acts a little bit more like his father, a little more strategic. And so he decides he's going to go quash this rebellion that's happening in Scotland, and he needs to raise an army in England. But that takes time and money and everything. So while he's doing that, he sends some instructions to his commissioners up in Scotland. Let me read from J.D. Douglas. Charles at first pretended to yield, but wrote to Hamilton, his appointed commissioner, I give you leave to flatter them with what hopes you please. So he's talking about the people in Scotland. Your chief end being now to win time until I be ready to suppress them. I will rather die than yield to those impertinent and damnable demands. The Covenanters were not to be denounced as traitors until the king's fleet had set sail for Scotland. It was not surprising that no reconciliation was ever effected with a monarch who could resort to such blatant subterfuge. Okay, so you see that he's saying, act like you're okay with everything while I get my army ready, and then I'll come up, and then we'll take care of business. Well, Charles does not have issues with Scotland only. He has issues with England, and more so later on. So he hasn't had an English parliament in 10 years. He's ruled all by himself. But the problem is under English law, the king can't actually raise taxes. Only parliament can do that. So how are you going to get an army together if you can't create taxes to pay for the army? And so reading from J.D. Douglas, Charles had no money for a war. The English parliament could have made him a grant, but no English parliament had met for 10 years. The result of the king's determination to be sole ruler. He did now call the short parliament, but it refused the necessary supplies, and he dissolved it after 3 weeks, so he can't get English parliament to do what he wants anymore. But he gets together this kind of, you know, small army anyways and takes them up north to fight the Scottish country. And the Covenanters muster an army in response to that. And that army, the flag they flew, if you remember our blue banner that says for Christ's crown and covenant, that was their flag in that battle. That's where that banner comes from. So it's a history of that. But that was the first time it was used as sort of their banner for that battle. Well, the armies come together. Charles realizes his army is a lot smaller and decides not to fight. They may have had some skirmishes, but they basically agreed to a treaty. And the treaty basically says, okay, I, Charles, will let General Assembly of Scotland and the Parliament of Scotland meet, and they can figure out if they want the church to be Presbyterian or Episcopal or whatever, and we'll go along with whatever it is. Or, you know, that was the treaty. So in 1640, 1641, the Assembly and the Parliament meet, and they decide on Presbyterianism, you know, and reflect the popular will of the people at that time. And so that frustrates Charles, but now he's, you know, calling this short parliament in England for 3 weeks didn't do anything. So he tries to call another parliament, which is called the Long Parliament, which eventually results in a civil war in England. And Charles loses, but that's beyond the scope of this class. But I do want to talk about, so we talked about the National Covenant. Now let's talk about the Solemn League and Covenant, which came a little later. And so now Charles is involved in a civil war between him and the Royalists and the English Parliament, or the Parliamentarianisms. That doesn't sound right, but, you know, however you say that word. And he's having a civil war. And so, and it's sort of equally matched. There's no determine winner. It's, you know, it's just going on and on. So the English Parliament goes to Scotland and says, hey, you guys have an army. Why don't you come and fight for us? You don't like Charles. You know, we'll work together. We'll beat him and then we'll be, you know, great. And Scotland says, okay, but you need to enter into a solemn religious covenant with us in order to do that. And that covenant was the Solemn League and Covenant. And it basically provided for the preservation of the Reformed religion in Scotland, saying, you know, we as Scotland, Ireland, and England will commit to preserving what we have in Scotland, will commit to reforming the church in England and Scotland to be like, I'm sorry, England and Ireland to be like Scotland, and so forth. So it was this agreement between, you know, the Parliament of England and the Parliament of Scotland to sort of make the entire Church of Great Britain reformed and Presbyterian. And so they signed the Solemn League and Covenant. The Scottish send their army down, help the English Parliament. They beat Charles, and they've won. Now that the war's over, England breaks their word to Scotland in two really key ways. First of all, Charles, who's defeated, is now in the custody of the Scottish army. England says, we want Charles. And Scotland says, you know, he's still a king. If we send him to you, you're going to kill him. So we'll send him to you if you promise not to kill him. And England says, yeah. They send him down. England has a trial, puts him on trial, condemns him, executes him. So they broke their word they wouldn't kill Charles. That frustrated Scotland. Not because they liked Charles, but it just, that wasn't the way you did things. You didn't kill your king. The other way was the Solemn League and Covenant that the English Parliament, you know, swore to. England never kept their side of the deal. They just sort of said, well, we were just doing that for political means. That we didn't really commit to that, and nothing ever came of that after that. So that will come into play more next week about why Scotland was so frustrated with England, but we'll leave it at that for now. So I do want to talk about the Westminster Assembly, and so, again, it's English. This is more about England, but you have all this conflict between Charles and the English Parliament. The English Parliament wins, and the English Parliament sort of calls for this assembly of divines. That's why we call it the Westminster Divines. It meant an assembly of kind of churchmen. They call for them to meet, and they're tasked basically with settling the government of the Church of England according to Scripture and reforming the doctrine of the Church. Okay, so you got a lot of different views in England at the time. You have, you know, kind of independent Congregationalists. You have Puritan Presbyterians. You have Episcopal, you know, Erastians. You have all these different viewpoints. And so the English Parliament says, why don't we have an assembly of all the different churchmen? You come together, you battle it out, debate it out. You come up with a document that you all agree to, and we'll use that sort of to settle the matter of what the English church will be. That was the goal of the Westminster Assembly. And it was made up of about 150 delegates from England. And then the other thing they did is they brought seven delegates from Scotland. But the seven delegates were consultative members, meaning they had privilege to debate and talk. But when it came down to a vote, they didn't have a vote. So it was made up of independents and Episcopals and Presbyterians, because if you've ever read the Westminster Standards, they're Presbyterian. I mean, it's amazing to me that it was meant to be sort of this all-inclusive. You know, everybody comes to the table and we hammer out an agreement. It's supposed to be sort of this unifying document, and yet it's so Presbyterian. How did that happen? And I think it really happened because the Presbyterian argument carried the day in the Westminster Assembly, and that was due in large part to the Scottish delegates that were there. They, again, didn't have a vote, but they were able to debate. And they had people like Samuel Rutherford, who wrote Lex Rex, if you've heard of that. Alexander Henderson, like I said before, those were some of the guys that came from Scotland. And another guy that came, his name was George Gillespie. And this is quote number 12. This is a long one, but I think this shows you that influence the Scottish delegates had over the entire assembly. Okay, so buckle up. It's a long one. This is J.D. Douglas. And remember, so the Westminster Assembly, you have 150 or so people in a room, and it's sort of like it's almost like Congress in a way. You know, you have a person is given the right to stand, you know, the moderator gives the floor over to this guy to say something, and then when he's done, another, you know, it's a kind of a controlled debate setting. And so that's, you know, just kind of picture that you're in that room. And so reading from J.D. Douglas, during the debate on church discipline, the Presbyterians found themselves opposed by the two other parties, the Independents and the Erastians. The former, the independents, who held what was adjudged to be the untenable position that the church had no power of excommunication, soon retired from the debating floor. So they kind of say, okay, you're right, we don't have an argument, and they sit down. The Erastians, though, admitting such a power, the power to excommunicate, placed it in the hands of the civil authority. Erastian means the church controls, or the government controls the church. So they're saying, yes, people can be excommunicated, and it's the government, though, that does that, that enforces that, not the church. One of their leaders, one of the Erastian leaders, the learned Selden, held forth at great length with a staggering display of minute rabbinical lore, striving to demonstrate that Matthew 18:15-17, the passage that was under dispute, contained no warrant for ecclesiastical jurisdiction, that's church discipline, but concerned the ordinary practice of the Jews in their common civil courts. Okay. Even the most erudite and able of the divines present were in no hurry to encounter such a formidable opponent. Samuel Rutherford, who's the author of Lex Rex, the story goes, turned to Gillespie and said, "Rise, George, rise up, man, and defend the right of the Lord Jesus Christ to govern by his own laws the church which he hath purchased with his blood." With every appearance of reluctance, Gillespie rose, gave first a summary of the previous speech, stripping it of all its cumbrous learning and reducing it to simple language. Then steadily, point by point, he completely refuted it, providing that the passage in question could not be interpreted or explained away to mean a mere reference to a civil court, and that the Jews both possessed and exercised the right of spiritual censures. The effect of Gillespie's speech was so great as not only to convince the assembly, but also to astonish and confound Selden himself. The Erastian leader is reported to have exclaimed in bitter mortification, "That young man, by this single speech, has swept away the learning and the labor of 10 years of my life." Okay, so anyway, so that's just like one story of, you know, I think the Westminster Assembly lasted for several years. And so, but I just, again, the Scottish delegates are there. They don't have a vote, but they were so persuasive in their arguments that the Westminster document or that came out, the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Catechisms, that they're extremely reformed, extremely Presbyterian, and I think it was because of that that thing. And just to read this quote 13 from J.G. Voss, "The Westminster Assembly itself really belongs to English rather than Scottish church history. Yet the Church of Scotland cooperated in the enterprise at the time, and the work of the Assembly has had far greater permanent effects in Scotland than in England. The chief doctrinal standards of all branches of Scottish Presbyterianism down to the present day were formulated by the Westminster Assembly of Divines." And even our own church, the RPCNA, if you go to our constitution, it starts with the Westminster Confession of Faith. That's kind of the primary part of our constitution. So, we're not... we're one of these Presbyterian churches he's talking about. So that's what I had today. Next week, we will look at how, you know, Charles I has been executed by England. We'll see how Charles II, his son, is restored to the throne after Oliver Cromwell dies. We'll get into that. We'll consider more the conflict between the Stuart dynasty on one side with their divine right of kings and the Scottish Covenanters on the other, and understand that controversy more. And then we'll be ready to look at the actual time of persecution. So that's where we're going, but we have time for questions or comments.